Yeah, I took a rather bold title, actually, those of you who have known me for longer than the last couple of years may know that this is not something, a problem that I've been working on all my life. This is something I started doing in spring of 2002, and it really started with a conversation through email with John Lavery at ARO. I sort of just chatting about things that they were interested in funding, and I said, you know, the swarming thing sounds really cool, and I have some crazy ideas, and he said, well, send me a white paper. So I did, and he liked it, and really the idea was one of, that has sort of taken off, not just me, I'm not the only one who's doing this, but it was to study these problems that come from biology and to think about how we can learn from these systems to design swarms of artificial, sort of artificial platforms, like, well, this is just one picture of the global hop, but, you know, there are many examples like this. So my talk is really going to span both some basic models for nature all the way to some work that we are doing here at UCLA on design of swarming algorithms. And I have a laundry list of people that I want to thank. Hopefully I may have forgotten somebody here, so hopefully I get everybody. So these are some students in my group, Yao Li. We're going to show some of his work here. He's Yao Li, raise your hand. Yeah, that's Yao Li. We're going to see his simulations coming up in just a few minutes. Also, some of the work done by some of our engineering students, Chung, Rick, Kevin, and also with some help from Jipu from Caltech and Bao. So you'll see some of the stuff we've done both with Richard Murray's group and on the Caltech multi-vehicle wireless testbed, and also on building our own testbed here at UCLA. Jipu is actually right there. Yep, Jipu from Caltech. And some of the postdocs in the group, Maria is giving a talk on Tuesday on some more of the details of some things I'm going to introduce today. And Chad is also giving a talk on Thursday. I'll mention some of his work as well. And then I have a number of collaborators as well. Emilio is here. There's Emilio. Yeah, hi, Emilio. And Mark Lewis isn't here, but one of his students. Where's Raluca? There we go. Raluca's here. From Alberta, Lincoln Chase, who's a statistical physicist here at UCLA. Carolyn Betcher is here from Raytheon. Carolyn, where are you? Hi, Carolyn. We worked with her group over the summer on a project. And Ira Schwartz is a collaborator, and he's also a co-organizer of this workshop. So that's a lot of acknowledgments. Okay, so I guess the problem really needs no introduction to this audience. You all are familiar with this problem. We've heard some wonderful talks this morning about locusts and also some discussion of fish. This is a wildebeest herd. This is a famous picture. A lot of you in mathematical biology know this picture of the wildebeest. And of course, the idea is one of trying to model these systems where you have fairly short-range communication between individual members of the swarm, but yet the swarm itself can span many, many such length scales. So there are really at least two scales in these problems. These are sort of the quintessential multi-scale problems in nature. And so I started looking at some continuum models. I'm actually a person who's trained in nonlinear PDEs, so we have to start with PDEs in my group. And this was something that Chad Topaz and I started looking at, I guess it was fall of it was spring of 02 probably, right? Something like that, fall of 02. Fall of 02, that's when you came to Duke. Yeah, so there have been a lot of models in the literature, especially in one dimension where you have a population that is conserved and it moves according to some velocity rule. And these are called kinematic models, by the way, where the velocity rule is prescribed as a function of the density of the swarm. And for a non-local example, so in other words, if your population is using some kind of sensing mechanism to see where neighbors are, maybe over some range of scales, then this velocity rule has to be a non-local rule. So the very simplest thing you can write down is a linear rule where the velocity is some function of density. So somehow your direction of motion is a nonlinear convolution with the density. This is sort of the simplest example that you can write down, mathematically simple, I mean. When you take the simplest mathematical example, in two space dimensions, which is the case that we looked at in this paper, in 2D, any vector field at all can be decomposed into two pieces. One is the incompressible part, which is the perpendicular gradient of some scalar function, phi, and also there's another part, which is the potential. So this is basically the Hodge decomposition theorem for two-dimensional vector fields. And so we decided to ask a very simple question, which is what kind of physical motions correspond to each of these two pieces in this general class of models? And we started with the incompressible case. Well, in the incompressible case, you have a conserved population, and the velocity depends non-locally linearly on density. Well, since this kernel is now the perpendicular gradient of a function, basically there's an analogy to a class of problems in fluid dynamics called vortex patches. And you can actually solve for the motion of the boundary of your swarm clump. And what happens is that it actually will just rotate in place, like so. It forms a vortex. And somewhat similar to some of the actual vortices that we've seen in the earlier talks today. So basically, if you're only looking at the incompressible part of the motion and you're in 2D and you want to conserve the population, and you also want the population to move, this is basically the, assuming they're not moving sort of left or right or up or down, they're sort of confined to some region, then this is the only motion that you can have with this kind of a role.
Is that because of the boundary conditions that they have?
Yeah, so that's, in fact, good question. So, hello? Okay, so if we go back, I'm leaving out actually something here. So if I'm assuming here that my kernel dies at infinity, which means that I can't get translational motion out of this model. So I want to look at just motion that's in a confined space, which means that my vector field dies at infinity, and for that type of motion, this is it. And the incompressible part leads to rotation. So that's one thing. And the other part, which is the potential part, my computer's a little slow today. There we go. The potential part leads to either aggregation or dispersion, depending on what kind of model we use. Now, the aggregation and dispersion does not lead to steady state sort of clumping solutions. So when you want to look for sort of aggregates that will form some kind of steady state clump as a swarm, you have to go to more nonlinear models. And that leads us to a whole class of models that, here's a sort of laundry list of earlier papers in the literature for these 1D models, where you have some kind of non-local attraction and some kind of local dispersion. So this would be on a very small scale. This is an anti-crowding mechanism, okay? And then this would be the attraction across some scale, the non-local attraction from one member to another. And like I said, there's been a lot of work in the literature. Also, more recently, some papers by Alt, Edelstein, Ketch, and McGillner. What we decided to do was look at this problem in multi-D, what happens in multi-D. And also, can we write down a model that is a little more physical than the ones that occurred in the literature? We wanted something that basically had all sort of the physical scales in it. So this is our model. What we do is we assume that there's a component of the velocity field, which is basically an average sensing of the nearby population that otherwise involves climbing gradients. So this kernel is an averaging throughout the nearby population, but the averaging is spatially decaying. That's because if you go far enough away, you can't sense anything. The sensing is very localized. You know, these animals cannot see long, long distances, nor can I. We also made a very simplified assumption in the model that it's isotropic. Obviously, a fish has eyes that are looking in certain directions. So that's a bit of a gross generalization, but perhaps on a, you know, if you think about the population as not having a preferred orientation, then this is not a crazy assumption. Then what you can do is you can rescale this to have sort of length scale in dimensionless units 1 and a weight in dimensionless units of 1. You also get a dimensionless parameter R, which lives in front of the anti-crowding term. So we also have our dispersal or overcrowding term, which is going to descend population gradients. We decided to use a local model there because it really is on a very small scale. And we decided that what really made sense physically is that you would not just have the gradient of rho as your velocity rule, but you would also have an additional weight of the density. That just says that if you, so basically the idea here is that if you have a very low population density, there's no reason to do anti-crowding, right? So it shouldn't depend, it shouldn't scale only with the gradient, it should also scale with the density itself. So this is sort of the simplest rule that takes both of those features into account. And then you get, and then there's a characteristic speed R, which we can make dimensionless. This basically turns out to be the only, there's just sort of one dimensionless parameter in this model when we do the rescaling. And then what you can do is you can look at the dynamics of this model. This is just a one-dimensional calculation, but the model makes perfectly good sense in multi-D. And you see that if you start with a random initial density, that it will sort of self-organize into clumps, and then the clumps over some time, longer time scale are attracted to each other, and eventually one big clump is formed. And this process here, basically from this stage to this stage, is what we call coarsening. Okay, another feature of the model is that there is a very nice mathematical Lyapunov function. There's a Lyapunov function for the model. This is a non-convex functional of the density that decreases in time. And if you look at one of these clump solutions, you discover that it is one of a family of steady state solutions that happens to live at the bottom of the potential well for that Lyapunov function. So we have a way to predict which clump is going to be the one that's achieved in sort of in the dynamic equilibrium state for this problem. Okay, so another question that we can ask, which I think is an important one and one that's sort of been one of the underlying themes of our research here at UCLA, is what happens for very large aggregations. If you want a model that makes sense for populations that can get sort of arbitrarily big, then you want to ask what's sort of the large aggregation limit for this particular model, and is that physical? Well, what you can do is, well, you can run a simulation, first of all, and see that when you have a very large, in fact, I'll show you, let's see a picture. Yeah, when these swarms get larger, they get, tend to get very flat on top. They sort of look like pancakes. So if we can ask ourselves, suppose it really has sort of a pancake or rectangular shape. And then what you can do is you can minimize the energy over all such shapes, and that actually gives you a prediction for the preferred swarm density in the center of the swarm. And so it predicts a density of 1.5 times R for this model, and a preferred swarm diameter size of L over 1.5 R. This actually is independent. What we found very interesting about this model is that it's independent of the particular choice of that averaging function, that sensing mechanism function. Okay, it depends on the on length scales associated with that function, but not on the shape of the kernel per se. Okay, so that's an important. So in other words, you could take two animals that have very different, you know, sort of depth perception and things like that, and if they move according to these same rules, it doesn't really matter how they're doing their local spatial averaging as long as they're doing it in some sense and that there's some die-off at infinity. This idea generalizes to 2D, and we're actually currently working on some very interesting problems connected to both the coarsening problem in 2D and also what happens to the boundary of the swarm. How can we model the boundary of the swarm as its own dynamics in 2D? And that's ongoing work with Chad Topaz and Dan Slepchev here at UCLA. And here are just some example calculations. If you, in 1D, if we take our density and we increase it, we see that the swarm size gets bigger and fatter, but eventually the swarm density, this is density as a function of position, eventually the density equilibrates to this 1.5 value for really large swarms. You get this pancake-like structure with the equilibrium density in the center, and then a very fast drop-off. So you really have a very localized clump, you know, like this, where the density is constant everywhere inside, and it drops off very sharply to zero on the boundary, which is definitely something that's seen in actual natural swarms. Here also is, as a function of the total mass of the swarm, here's the density at the center of the swarm as a function of total mass. And you see that it does asymptote to this constant state. Okay, so that's one of the projects. That's the PDE project in our group. At least the one that I'm working on. Chad has some stuff he's working on too, I believe.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So all of these things that you have told us are subject to the starting thing where your current density in the continuity equation is bilinear and non-local. in the density, right? Did I understand that right?
The model is, yeah, here's the model. Yeah, we're assuming that this part of, the anti-crowding term is bilinear in the velocity.
I didn't mean that. I meant just the first term, way it is.
Yes,
is that it is, so that if I just call that the current density,
yes,
it has got a road twice, and it has got non-local in space.
Correct.
Right? Yeah.
Correct.
So this is something that you take always as the foundation of what you.
Well, for this one, for this one project, we're using.
For this one project.
Yeah, and so all the results that I've just described are in a manuscript that's about to appear in the Bulletin of Math Biology. Do we know when it's coming out? We don't know.
And.
But there's a copy of it on my website if you want to download the paper.
And as just a model, or is something fundamental that it should be bilinear and non-local? I think I understand.
Okay, so back to the model. Why did we choose this?
Yes.
Okay.
That particular.
Sure.
Point.
So this is just a standard conservation law. The only thing that we don't, basically the thing you have to choose is what's inside the brackets. What's your
right.
velocity rule?
Right. Okay. So that
this is a standard kinematic. Conservation law. This is a kinematic conservation law. We're not using force laws to determine the velocity. We're actually prescribing it fixed. This kinematic means that, you know, once you lay down the density, you then have a prescribed velocity field that comes. It's a functional of the density directly. It doesn't have its own momentum equation. Okay, so that's what I mean by a kinematic.
Full equation is kinematic in the sense that it's the continuity equation. But my question was to write that the velocity is grad k star rho.
Yeah, minus the term.
Yeah, and if we, I was going to say, forget that term.
Yeah, we just decided to look at that. This is a very reasonable model to use because this term is really the aggregation term in the model. Okay, what we're saying, so let's kind of look at this. So the point is that grad k star rho is the same thing as k star of grad rho. I'll just say that. And so you can think of this as climbing density gradients, okay, but with some spatial averaging. You should think of k here as a spatial averaging kernel, you know, like a mollifier. I'm a mathematician, so I sometimes use mathematical language. But it could be a Gaussian, but it could be something else too. It could be sort of a standard exponential. It could be just a box function. You know, just some way to do spatial averaging.
It's positive for mass one, right?
Yeah, we rescale it so it has mass one. Hey, Stan, how you doing? Okay, my good colleague Stan Osher. Yeah, okay, director of special projects at IBM. Okay, all right, so. So I'm going to cover a bunch of different topics from the group because some of my colleagues are going to go into more details on these models. I'm going to talk a little bit about a class of particle models, which is going to tie in very well to the talk that Ian gave this morning. So this is work with Maria, who's going to tell you even more about this on Tuesday. Yao Li, who we just saw, who's over there, green shirt, me, and Lincoln Chase, who is a good colleague in my department in statistical physics. This is work that's going to appear, I believe, in a week or two in Physical Review Letters. And we got interested in a class of, we really like this paper by Herbie Levine and his colleagues. I think is he coming to this? Herbie Levine?
No,
I don't know. Okay. Well, we tried to get him. At any rate, they wrote a paper in PRE in 2000 looking at not this model but a very similar class of models. These models have appeared in a number of different papers in the literature. We're certainly not the first to invent this class of models. But just to kind of go through what it is, so this now is not a kinematic model, this is a dynamic model, but this is also a discrete model. So we have a collection of particles, such as, for example, the fish here. Xi is the position of the ith particle. We assume that the ith particle has velocity v, and v satisfies the following force law. So this is the mass times acceleration, and we have self-propulsion in the direction that it's currently headed with strength alpha. There's a cubic drag minus beta vi squared. Sort of cubic drag term. So in the absence of any other effects, just this dynamic right here will equilibrate to a constant speed. Okay, you'll just keep on moving in the direction you're already heading and equilibrate to a constant speed. But then things get interesting when you add pairwise interactions between the particles. Okay, and so we chose, for the pairwise interactions, we chose this Morse potential, which is a fairly common model from biology. This, the Morse potential does appear in the Levine paper. They used a different law here, but they did use the Morse potential. When you take this model and you run a simulation with the number of particles, you see many of these morphological patterns that we've discussed already in the workshop this morning, such as the flocks and the mills and things like that. This mill is a very characteristic one that occurs in this model. So we started looking at this, thinking a little bit more towards how can we look at this system wearing the hat of a classical statistical physicist, that's what Lincoln is, and when you remove self-propulsion and drag, this is a Hamiltonian system. And its many-body dynamics are really dictated by classical statistical mechanics. And one of the questions that people from that community ask is whether the proper thermodynamics is what's called H-stable. If you have this situation, then you also have a temperature that would come in from, for example, adding Brownian motion to the system. So now what we're doing is we're basically taking this classical problem, this model is taking this classical problem and adding self-propulsion and drag. This is now the non-conservative case. And the question we ask is what role does the self-propulsion and drag play? It does actually, in some sense, play a role kind of a temperature. But also, the non-H-stable regime, which is not considered so much in this case, but in this case, the non-H-stable regime is the one that leads to many of the interesting patterns that we have seen, the ones that tend to correspond to a lot of the patterns in nature. For example, this, what you'll see is that this mill with a hollow core in the center, we see that it only occurs in the non-H-stable regime for this model. So what is H-stability? Okay, so H-stability for thermodynamic systems, it's a very simple idea. You have an n-particle system, you mathematically look at the limit as n goes to infinity, and you ask that the free energy per particle, which is the limit as n goes to infinity of E of n over n, exists. And if you don't have that, then you can get a collapse of the system. H-stability means it will not collapse. As you increase the number of particles, the system maintains its sort of nice behavior. So this is the idea. It's very classical. I mean, there are books that students learn from when they're in graduate school in this topic, but not so much. They have, the books do not address the case, the swarming case, where you add self-propulsion and drag to the system. So you can go back to the Morse potential, the one that we're considering, and you can make the following phase diagram. So we have on this axis the ratio of attractive to repulsive to attractive length scales in the potential, and this axis is the ratio of the strength of the two terms, the attractive and repulsive. The strength of the coefficient in front of those terms. And you get a phase diagram that looks like this. So there's a piece that is to the right of this line and north of this line over here, which is, which is stable. And then you have another piece, which is sort of over here, and then down here, which is catastrophic. So now what I'm going to do is show you some movies. These are courtesy of Yael Lee, of two different morphologies that occur in the two regimes. And so on the left, they're both going to self-organize into mills. On the left is the H-stable case, and on the right is an example from the catastrophic regime. Now, I should mention that some of the H-stable parameters will just lead to the particles flying apart. They won't stick together. So you have to pick H-stable parameters in a sort of narrow range to even get them to stay self-organized. But you can do that, and you see that they, it looks all actually like we have a lot of noise in the system here. There's actually no noise. We're not putting in, except from numerical error, round off and things like that, and discretization error. We're not putting in any noise in the system, and you can see that eventually it self-organizes into a lovely mill, but notice that there's no center of the mill. And it turns out this is basically a rigid body rotation, very well described by rigid body rotation. Whereas this mill has all the particles traveling at the same speed, very much like in Ian's model, and there's a hollow core. Now, this is in the catastrophic regime. Anyone want to guess what happens if we take this system and we increase the number of particles? Does it get bigger or smaller? It shrinks. If you double the number of particles, the system size actually gets smaller and the particles pack more closely.
Why do you call it catastrophic?
It's the non-H stable case. That's, I guess, it's standard in the literature. Yes.
You said H stable, I don't know what H stable is, but you said H stable is defined in the case where it was a Hamiltonian system.
Yeah, it's the energy.
And now you're,
yeah.
You're saying you put these extra terms in, so it's no longer Hamiltonian.
Correct.
So what does it mean? I don't.
Yeah. So, but
what,
okay.
What
yeah.
is it?
So if you look at the energy per particle, so basically what's happening is that.
So what is the energy?
Yeah. So it's the energy associated with the pairwise interaction term. Okay, the potential, yeah. And what's happening here in this in the catastrophic case is that each particle on its own is equilibrating to a speed where at least locally in time, the attraction, the self-propulsion and drag are balanced, okay?
But I'm just asking you to tell me, give me a definition of what
This is it. So you take the energy associated with the pairwise, just the pairwise interaction term of the potential. And you ask in the limit as n goes to infinity is E of n over n. Does this exist or not? There is an equivalent calculation that you can do, which is you take the potential in n space dimensions, whatever dimension you're working in, and you just integrate it. And if it's negative, then if that integral is negative, then it's in the catastrophic regime. In other words, it's energetically more favorable to take the particles and pack them more closely together until you get to the limit where they really feel only repulsion from each other. They're so closely packed. Yeah.
Is there a relationship between instability and time to settle down? Like it seems like the instable part takes more time to settle down. In the simulation.
The time to equilibrate.
Yeah,
that's not something that we've spent much time studying. You know, we haven't. I can't tell you. Maybe Yali, do you know?
Because if we now dimensionalize the equation, then it is both stable. So we need the smaller speed and the characteristic.
So the speed, yeah, okay, yeah, that's true. If we're in the, one feature of this model is if you're in the H-stable regime,
right.
You can't have the particle speeds too much because they're more likely to fly apart because of the nature of the potential that you're taking. Yeah.
Since it's not true that the Morse potential necessarily is catastrophic, is it the parameters of the Morse potential that you choose that are making it catastrophic?
Exactly, and this is our phase diagram for those parameters. In other words, the Morse potential has four parameters in it, the attractive and repulsive length scales and the
right.
coefficients in front of those terms. And so we have on one axis the ratio of the attractive versus, these are two-dimensionless parameters in the model. And this is the H-stability diagram for the Morse potential.
Yeah, but as far as the qualitative shape in space is concerned, it's still the standard one that comes up, goes up to infinity, comes down, and then has an escape, right?
Yes. Well, it depends which regime you're in. So there are parts of this diagram where the parameters are such that the potential may just look like this, for example. You know, I mean, it may not have a well. But for example, if you're in this regime here or in this regime up here, which includes both catastrophic and H stable, you have a local well.
Okay. In the catastrophic, there is still a well.
Correct.
There can still be
in this,
a well.
And the example that I showed you with the mill is right in this regime here. Okay, this example that I just showed you on the right where it formed a nice mill with a hole is in that regime.
Okay. And the reason that it is catastrophic and it is giving you all these interesting aspects and so on are for the specific parameters that you take there, right?
Yeah, but the point is that if you choose your potential anywhere in this regime and you use that as your model, the mill, as you increase the number of particles in the problem, that mill is actually going to collapse. It's going to get smaller and more densely packed, which we thought was interesting. I mean, if you're going to use it to model biological systems, you know, I mean, at some point they're not going to do that anymore. Even if they do that, they won't do that forever. So we thought that was interesting. And then there's another feature, and this is also reminds me of some of the things that Ian shown in his talk. In the catastrophic regime, you can also achieve the following kinds of dynamics. These are double spirals that form, that persist for very long periods of time, depending on parameters. And so you have basically two spirals superimposed on each other with an empty core. And so you have some number of particles going counterclockwise, another number going clockwise, and this number doesn't stay fixed in time. Some will switch back and forth from one state to the other state over time.
Is that where the repulsion, I get that, but only if I sort of turn repulsion off and make repulsion really, really small.
This is all soft core, so they can go through each other. In fact, if you make it hard core, this goes away. This double mill will turn into a single mill if you make it hard core.
You take the repulsion off, you get some crazy sort of other geometrical shapes that would occur. Then as soon as you put repulsion back in, they disappear and you just get the...
Well, I'll show you some other shapes. I'll show you some other shapes. So. Yeah, this one, the double spiral, is also in this regime down in here. Yeah. In fact, the double spiral and the single spiral can coexist for exactly the same set of parameters and numbers. It's just a matter of initial conditions. You can take the double spiral, and while it's in the double spiral, you can take... Yaoli has this lovely code, right? He's written in OpenGL, and he can go in and put in particles by hand and then stop it, put in particles and turn them on again and let them go. And if you take them all the ones going the other direction and turn them around and then let them go again, that it'll just self-organize into a single rotating mill. That's what'll happen. So that's kind of cute. I will mention that, of course, the flocks occur for these models as well. I mean, you're going to see the flocks can actually make up sort of a subset of another interesting pattern that can happen. Now I'm going to show you two patterns that I haven't really seen so much in other works, but now we're going to look basically in this little region down here, and one of them is going to be on this line here, and the other one I believe is down in this region here. And so let's go to that case. So the ring is on the line. This is ring formation. If you're right on that boundary, the particles will actually... if you just let them equilibrate a little bit, they will all end up on a ring of fixed radius, which we can predict. We have an analytical formula for the radius of the ring. There's two outliers, but they're going to end up on the ring eventually. If you let them, just be a little patient, they'll get there. And this we have a fixed formula for. We have an analytical formula to predict that. It also does collapse. As you increase n, that ring will get smaller and smaller. Now, here's another case where we get, this is cute, because what we're going to get are little swarmlets that will rotate around each other. So we have sort of a two-scale system here. So you can see they're sort of forming small clumps, and the small clumps will, here they go. So this is sort of a nice coarsening process, because you're going to get a bunch of very small number of clumps that are going to rotate about each other. Just give them a little time. The movie's a little jerky. It's not like that when you actually, in real life, my computer seems to be having some jerky motion right now for some reason. Okay, but you can see these little swarmlets that are forming, right? And then now they're all rotating about each other. And then this state will persist for a long time. So each of these little groups looks like an individual flock, okay? But then the flocks are rotating about a central point. So that's another interesting pattern that can form for this class of models. And then here's our comparison for the ring between the numerical and analytical formula for the ring. So it looks like we got that. We have also been working on a continuum model, which actually, interestingly enough, the continuum, so this is a bit of work in progress, the continuum model seems to hold very well in the catastrophic case where you have this kind of a mill. We can get the mill to form for the continuum model, and the density profile as a function of radius looks pretty darn close to the density that you get from averaging the motion of the particles. So this continuum model is a dynamic PDE model, non-local PDE model. It's sort of the natural one that you would expect coming from the swarms. So this is another, you know, this is sort of, I'm showing you sort of what we've done and some things we're working on right now on this particle problem. But we're hoping to get ideas from these biological systems to come up with algorithms for artificial systems as well. So that's become an exciting problem that we've been working on in addition to these biological models. So there are some very natural problems, you know, from industry and from defense and environmental problems that can possibly use such collections of vehicles. One famous problem is one that I believe Naomi is going to talk about in her talk, where they have underwater vehicles that go into Monterey Bay and they're measuring properties. I think it's algae. Is that right? Is it algae blooms in Monterey Bay that you're looking at? Or more than that? Yeah, I guess you're looking now at whales out in off the coast of New England, too. Yeah, on the other coast. Okay. So there are quite a lot of chemical plumes. You could look at oil spills, a lot of things in the ocean, but you could also send cars or terrestrial vehicles on land or even inside a building. And so we want to use them to perform various tasks. That's the general idea. But you'd like some kind of an algorithm that's going to scale with number. You know, so the more you have, the more you can take advantage of them. And we don't want to have to worry about some kind of centralized control algorithm that would be sort of prohibitively expensive computationally as we increase the number. So we're looking for decentralized methods. So I'll mention a problem that we worked on a few years ago in boundary tracking. We were looking at taking ideas from image processing. These are the image snake methods, which are very nicely Lagrangian methods, which lend themselves quite well to applications involving sensors and mobile vehicles. And then we thought about, in real life, what happens when you have sort of a typical sensor measuring sort of, say, chemical concentration in an environment. Typically, these are very crude sensors that can't measure gradients, so we wanted to adapt these ideas to binary sensors, and also where the number of vehicles were rather small. So the image snake problem basically takes this is another PDE method, where we have a curve Z, this is now a 2D problem, curve Z in the plane. Z is parameterized by a variable S. There's also a function that is going to attract the curve to some region of interest. Typically in image processing, this would be an edge of an image. In our problem, it would be a level set of some concentration, for example, in the environment. And then what you can do is take this problem and just discretize it with, say, uniform spacing in H and S. If you have n vehicles, you would want to choose n nodes. Each node would correspond to an agent. Zi would denote the position of the ith agent. This reduces to a couple set of ODEs for the position of each vehicle. And then basically this gives you a first, you can think of this as almost, sort of handing you a first order control law for your vehicle system, provided that you can measure this. Okay, that's the trick, is you have to be able to measure this. Everything else, if you know the position of all the other vehicles, this part is easy, then this is the part that's tricky. That's the environmental part. So this is a paper with Dan Marthaler where we used a level set idea. Suppose we're looking for a concentration of some environmental substance. We then choose P to be minus the concentration minus some base concentration squared. This reduces the problem by one derivative from the classical type of P that's used in image processing, so we have one derivative less. And here are just some sample numerical calculations for that problem. Let's see. Here we go. So this is our fixed environmental. So this could be like an oil slick, and we're trying to find the edge, and these are the agents, and they are sort of slowly over time. We also have an algorithm where they have to constantly move, so you could imagine that you're in the water and you're using some kind of torpedo-shaped robot that has to, if you turn it off, it's going to sink. You don't want that to happen, so they have to continually move. We decided to have them move in the direction tangential to the edge of the boundary. That's pretty easy, and it preserves the boundary tracking very well, and it does a pretty good job. Now, what's nice about this idea is that if an individual vehicle fails, as long as they can reconstruct the connection from one vehicle to the next, the algorithm will just continue on and it's stable to vehicle failure. Here what we're doing is we're randomly killing off agents one at a time. And you can see as the vehicles get killed off, the algorithm will still perform. Because we're actually solving a PDE, if we get two cores, we're not going to do such a good job. Okay, so this, the only time this breaks down is when the you know, the agents get really sparse. When they get really, really sparse, you can say, well, let's turn off the PDE and let's just have them operate individually. And so you can literally have them just locate using the gradient. You can set up a vector field and they can follow the edge of this contour, provided there's no noise in the system. This works very well without noise, but if you have a very noisy system, then these guys will just go all over the place. The snake bait, the PDE idea, does really well at damping the noise, spatial noise in the system. Okay, so that was one idea. Okay, let's go back here. Okay. Yeah.
How do we control the density on the boundary? It seems like depending on whether the shape is concave or convex,
yeah,
the density changes, and it changes drastically.
That's a question that's better answered after my talk, because it would take too long to answer. But it's a really good question. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay. It is a Lagrangian method, so you are going to have to deal with that issue. Okay. So now, one other thing to say is that there, you can do something very interesting to study communication and stability. There's a nice thing that comes out of classical numerical analysis for the PDE, which is that if you only have nearest neighbor coupling in communication, then the snake algorithm requires very frequent communication for stability. On the other hand, if you're able to communicate globally across the entire network, then you can show that this is effectively unconditionally stable. We also were able to show in numerical simulation that this method can be adapted to vehicles that communicate asynchronously, okay, which is important if you're doing, say, ocean sampling. Then we thought about what happens if you have vehicles with sensors that can only measure whether they're inside or outside of the region of interest. They cannot measure gradients. The previous method has to be thrown out, and we need something better. And we decided on an idea which is very reminiscent of the ants in Ian's talk with the antenna that are measuring the pheromone, and they're snaking in and out of that trail. So we are doing the same thing with our robots here. In this case, what we do is we take an individual robot and we have it just travel in a circle until it hits the boundary of our region of interest. The sensor then picks up that it's entered that region, and all of a sudden, as soon as we enter that region, we just change the direction of rotation of the motion, which causes it to travel in the other direction, and eventually it'll go outside, and you see what happens. As long as the length scale of the radius of curvature of this circular motion is small compared to the typical length scale of the curvature of the boundary, you will just snake in and out and follow the boundary around. Of course, you know, here's an example where that length scale is, there's a pinch off and that length scale gets too small, and you may miss parts of the boundary in this kind of situation. But if you have a rather big, fat boundary like this, you ought to be able to track it using this very simple method. Then if you have multiple vehicles, you need to space them out. We proposed a very simple gas law, and I should mention that this idea with the gas law was due to Matthew Kemp, who some of you may know from the underwater vehicles community. He works at Necton Research. He's a physicist at Necton Research in Research Triangle Park. It's an underwater robotics company. So there's our gas law. So then we decided, wouldn't it be fun if we could see if this actually works? And so we were invited to Richard Murray's lab in summer of 2004. I think Richard's here. Is he here now? Maybe not. Anyway, Richard's giving a talk later on in this workshop. We were invited there. We went there with three undergraduates from UCLA, engineering students, and we had this wonderful test bed. This is a vehicle on the test bed. It's a Kelly. The Kelly has a 700 megahertz laptop computer right there, minus the screen. It has two ducted fans. It sits on casters, so it'll just roll. If you give it a push, it'll just go in the direction you push it. It has a gyro. It has a hat. The hat is very important. The hat has a barcode on the top that you can see from overhead, and there are four cameras positioned overhead that image the floor in real time and locate each of the vehicles and then communicate through wireless communication with each of the vehicles, and they also can communicate with each other. So that's the platform, and that's an example. The vehicle is about that big. Okay, and this is about 25 feet across, and there's a post in the middle. So we went there, and and we took three Kellys and we tried out this algorithm, and this is just some data from a run on the floor at Caltech. There are the positions of each of the Kellys as they're collectively traversing the boundary of this rather monkey-shaped red object. And these are the boundary points that they detect through this algorithm. And here is a video clip of the same algorithm with a different initial condition and a different boundary. And you can hear that they make noise. They're kind of loud. The fans are kind of screechy. My computer's a little jerky today. But anyway, there are the 1, 2, 3 Kellys. You can see the barcode on top. And this is an overhead overhead view of what's going on. And you can see the radius that each of the, or the circle that each of the vehicles is trying to follow as it's determining whether it's inside or outside and making crossings. So this actually was put together by Cheng Shui, who was an undergraduate at the time at UCLA. And we wrote this up and published it in the ACC last year in 2005. So we were so inspired by the Caltech platform that we thought, well, heck, let's build one here at UCLA. And this was with some great ideas from my colleague Emilio Frizzoli in mechanical engineering. Emilio's here too. There's Emilio. Okay. A couple of our graduate students, Chang is, by the way, who gave that paper last year, is now a master student. And Rick is another master student. And Kevin was an undergraduate RU student. And the math department was kind enough to give us space on the third floor. It's called now called the Applied Math Lab. We renovated the space. And in one half of the space, we built this lovely platform. It consists, ours is much smaller than Caltech. We don't have the space that they have. But we decided to not only scale down the testbed area size, but we also decided to scale down the vehicle. So here's our vehicle. It's 5.3 centimeters on one side and 6.4 centimeters on another side. It's about this big. Okay, it's a dumb vehicle. It has no processing on board. It just has, it just picks up a radio signal that tells it whether it's going to go or not and whether it's going to turn. But we do have a very similar overhead camera tracking system with barcodes and all. We really liked that and we found it worked very well. So we built one just like that. And then the information from the cameras is processed by a tracking computer, which is a Windows machine. It's a it's a 3 gigahertz Windows machine, which is then that information is then sent over Ethernet to a machine right next to it, which is running Linux, and that's the vehicle's control machine. We're running simultaneous algorithms, one for each of the vehicles, to sort of simulate what it would be like if we were computing on board. And this one has the algorithms for the motion control of the vehicles, which then get sent to the microcontroller board with the radio antennas, which then give the commands to the vehicles. So that's what we did. And here is a demo. I have a couple of little demos of the platform. By the way, we are going to publish a paper about the platform construction and some of its performances in the ACC this year in 2006. So here's a demo. Here we go. A couple of movies, and that'll be it. And of course, what we'd like to do is do some really interesting collective motion algorithms with this platform. We haven't, I guess we're kind of doing that now. We're running some flocking algorithms on the platform. This just takes a second. So this is one video clip, just a short one, showing you close up the vehicles. And there's one driving a course. That's actually the campus shuttle route projected onto our testbed floor. And then this is one where they're doing a patrol algorithm. There's three of them together doing a patrol algorithm. So that's just takes a second to load up the movie. Okay. So in this case, this is an algorithm where each vehicle has a section of the floor that it's patrolling, and the student has a target on a stick. So the target, boom, the target now is imaged by the computer, and then one of the vehicles has to go and visit the site of the target. There's another target. This vehicle is going to make a course correction and see that, go visit that site. Here comes another target, and now that vehicle makes a course correction to go see that site. My computer seems to be running kind of jerky today. I'm not sure why. It doesn't usually do this. So they are running very smoothly. It's not a jerky motion anymore. That's just the computer. So that gives you an idea of sort of the multifaceted research program going on here in applied mathematics at UCLA and Swarming. And that's, you know, sort of why we chose the title of the conference. I think actually I picked the title for my talk before we chose the conference title. So so anyway, that kind of gives you an idea of what we're doing. A lot of us are here this week at the workshop, and please come and talk to us if you have questions about what we're doing. Thanks very much.